Every museum has its most memorable works of art. You know, the paintings or objects that draw you in and hold your attention. This is Erin Jones, director of the Museum and Gallery at Bob Jones University, with M&G's monthly Art Break podcast. This month's focus features current M&G staff, former staff, and volunteers sharing their favorite works found in M&G's collection. Listen as they describe their favorite object and see if you can glimpse in your mind's eye just why their choice is so special.
My name's Blaine Wellgraven, and I worked for 4 years as the grant specialist at the Museum and Gallery. Today, I actually work for a fintech company called Earnest. My role at Earnest is to manage our support team and our technical support team. But I've always retained a real love for what M&G stood for, and I retain a lot of love for the different portraits that they've collected over the years, different paintings, different works of art. I think one of my personal favorites, both because of its style and content, but also because of some of the thematic qualities, remains The Hiding of Moses. The Hiding of Moses is a painting done by Sebastian Bourdon. And Sebastian was a part of, you know, this incredible, really growing, thriving French Baroque movement in the 17th century. The French had been overlooked in the previous century. Their work wasn't quite as ideal or quite as prestigious as you would say the Dutch in particular. But he had come from a strict Calvinist family, Bourdon had, and he had actually been able to, I believe it was about 1636 in Rome, he was able to visit. And he actually studied with some of the greatest painters. I believe he studied with the Dutch Golden Age painter, Peter van Leer, who was known as Bambioccio, I believe is how it's pronounced. And he was also able to study with a Frenchman named Nicolas Poussin. And Poussin was kind of this school of painting that emphasized, you know, very carefully laid out geometric paintings that were serene and pristine and sort of emulated this kind of Platonic ideal. And when you first look at The Hiding of Moses, where its interest is really strong for me, is that it does emulate all those features. On the first glance, it's a very calm, serene, placid painting, very regal. You feel like you could be watching a scene out of Ben-Hur. It's just beautiful to look at. It's only upon stopping and looking at it, though, a little more closely, you realize that this is indeed The Hiding of Moses, which is in itself very unique. You see the family clustered by the side of the river. And again, their poses are very noble and serene. But if you look closely, you can see the emotion that's present there. And it's unusual because most of these paintings, M&G's former curator John Nolan once noted that it's very, very rare to find a painting with The Hiding of Moses. It's far more common to find a painting with The Discovery of Moses by Pharaoh's Daughter. But this is deeply personal. It's familial. It's the family with the father present and the mother preparing to say goodbye. So there's that very emotional aspect. And if you look even closer, you can see against the serene background, you know, you've got these beautiful arches and these pillars. There's an obelisk and a dais. They're all there creating this just, you know, beautiful, tranquil environment. But you look back to the upper left corner, middle left corner of the painting, you see that there is someone who appears to be clutching a baby, a mother, and appears to be being pursued by what looks to be a guard. So even against this tranquil background with these Romanesque columns and these, you know, Platonic lines and this geometric, you know, solidity, there's terror, there's fear. And against that, Bourdon has chosen to portray the family actually in the act of hiding Moses. And I think there's also the personal aspect to this too. Bourdon himself had to flee the Spanish Inquisition in 1638. So he knew what it was like to have to flee from one place after being denounced literally as a heretic and having to go on the run from what he would have called his home. And I think for anyone who's ever had to either A, experience the sense of place that home provides, and B, ever had to leave it, however briefly or for whatever reason, this painting conveys a deep deal of meaning that goes far beyond the initial overview of this tranquil environment. There's terror, there's love, there's emotion. They're all present here in this painting, The Hiding of Moses by Sebastian Bourdon. So that's what I love about this painting.
Hello, my name is Kate Jones, and I wanted to talk to you about one of my favorite works of art today, and just a little bit of background about me. I worked in the museum and gallery for a couple summers while I was in high school, and I'd been part of Kids Create before and through all of that, so I was pretty familiar with the space and a lot of the pieces, but gardening really took it to another level, and I'm really thankful because now I have memories of all of these pieces, and I remember which galleries they were in, and I'm glad that I can kind of hold that in my mind. But the favorite piece today that I wanted to talk about is a really beautiful portrait by Giuseppe de Ribera, and it's called Ecce Homo, also known as Behold the Man in the Latin. And I love this piece because when you walked in to the gallery that was housing it, we called it the Spanish Gallery, and you walked in and you saw it immediately. And it was actually a pretty small piece, and it's sitting next to these very big pieces, but your eye instantly goes all the way across the room to this one picture on the wall. And I loved that, and it's absolutely stunning. It's Christ, and he's looking right at you, and he's holding a broken reed in his hand, and he's wearing the crown of thorns on his head. And it's lovely. I believe it was painted around 1638, and the lighting in it is some of my favorite. It's a very simple, almost, piece. There's not a lot of colors in it, and it's just Christ with a dark background, and he has dark hair, dark eyes, this very pale but striking skin, and he's wearing the red of the robe that the soldiers put him in right before he was crucified. And it's interesting to think from the scripture about the timing around this piece. So Behold the Man comes from the passage in John 19 where Pilate brings Christ out after he's been beaten by the soldiers and after they've shoved this crown of thorns onto his head and put the robe onto him. And he says to the Jews, "Here, behold the man." And that's just a beautiful part of scripture. And I think it's interesting that Ribera chose to use the reed because it goes back to a passage in Isaiah 42. And I just want to read a couple verses from it because it really stands out in the whole context of the story within which he's painting the picture. So this is verses 2 and 3 from 42. "He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out." So essentially, with the reed, he's pointing back to these verses and saying, first of all, the Lord is fulfilling the prophecy in this moment. And it almost foreshadows the brokenness of the reed, saying that I'm not going to break anybody else, but I will be broken for the sins of all other people. So he already knows. He's pointing at his death. And I think Ribera captures the silence that is talked about in verse 2 so perfectly, just in the look that Christ has, because he's looking straight out almost in, it's not resignation, it's a peace, and it's the knowledge that I am doing this for my dearly beloved children, and I know that I'm going to die, but that is the will of God, and so that's what I'm going to do. And yes, that's the piece I love.
Well, my name is Katie Neal, and I had the opportunity to be a graduate assistant at the Museum and Gallery at Bob Jones University while I was working on my master's degree in biblical counseling. I worked in the gift shop there, as well as served as a docent, leading tours, and even had the opportunity to craft a tour called The Reformation in Pictures, which was a visual walk through M&G's collection, telling the story of the Protestant Reformation, as we could see through the lens of various objects and paintings in the collection. The painting I am talking about today, I would say, is the pinnacle painting in that tour. And that painting is called Wittenberg, October 31st, 1517, and was done by Eric Crow. So this is definitely what I would describe as a dramatic and an incredibly detailed historical painting, which are two of the reasons why I love it so much. In the center of the painting, we see Martin Luther nailing the 95 Theses onto the University of Wittenberg chapel door, which tradition tells us, of course, was done on October 31st, 1517. So we're fast approaching over that event, which took place 503 years ago. He is surrounded by a host of people who played a significant role in his life and also impacted the story of the Protestant Reformation. Some are well known and others not so well known. Probably one of the most well known is Johann Tetzel, the seller of indulgences, who is pictured on the left-hand side of the painting riding a horse, and he is holding papers that, if you look closely at the detail in the painting, actually have numbers on them. And of course, Tetzel was the one who was selling indulgences, and these papers have numbers on them. The numbers signify the years that an individual could purchase off of a loved one's stay in purgatory. He's also holding a coffer, which, you know, goes along with the jingle that has been well known and has been attached to him over the years, whether or not he actually said it or not. When the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. And Luther's 95 Theses were written expressly opposing Tetzel's selling of indulgences, which Luther believed was unbiblical. We also see on the left-hand side Margaret of Munsterberg, the adamant Catholic regent in the area who opposed Luther. It's interesting because we know that her sons, one of whom is seen clinging to her skirt in the painting, became Protestants in their adult years, and one was actually ordained by Luther. And then we move over to the right-hand side of the painting, which is what I would consider more of the Protestant side, and we see Catherine von Bora, my personal favorite character in Luther's life. She was a nun, and that's how we see her depicted in the painting, in the garb of a nun, because that was what she was before she believed the teachings of the Reformation and escaped the convent and then later married Martin Luther. We also see his parents and sister pictured as well. And then one character, the gentleman whose face we see who is looking right out at us directly, is Lucas Cranach the Elder. And Cranach is interesting because not only was he an incredible Renaissance painter, you will see his works in museums in the U.S. and Europe, but he was also a personal friend of Martin Luther. Of course, most of these people would not have been at the scene when Martin Luther was actually nailing the 95 Theses, but it is very interesting the way Crow painted them all into the scene and making it very interesting to study. I particularly love this painting because I love history, especially Reformation history, and I think this painting is a beautiful example of how art can and should make history come alive for us. Bonnie Merkel, who did a lot of my docent training, did a ton of research on this painting, which she shared with me. And a lot of the detail work that we know about the painting comes from her research. And I think one of the things that she inspired me with was how whenever you zero in and are interested in a particular detail that you may see in a painting, study it out and you might come up with some very interesting information and discoveries that make the work more meaningful for everyone.
Hi, I just want to thank M&G for the opportunity to share one of my favorite paintings at the museum and gallery. My name is David Basinger. I was a guard supervisor there, also helped out with curating work, and I enjoyed and found a love for art history there, and I even was able to publish some articles relating to art history for my academic work. Currently, I'm a realtor in Greenville, South Carolina, been so for the last 8 years. My favorite painting, and this is one that was in the back of the museum, I would often walk past it while I was checking on the guards. Of course, I was in grad school, so lots of pressure on you while you're doing that and working. And My favorite painting was the Martyrdom of St. Perpetua and Felicitas. That's not probably a natural one to pick, but it was important to me. Of course, that painting depicts the death of two particular women. There were five other gentlemen that lost their lives there, but this painting depicts two women, Perpetua, a noble woman, and Felicitas, a slave who had just given birth, actually, to a child. The painting is dramatic. It's quite romantic in the sense of the time period. It was painted in 1880 by Félix Lullière, and he painted in the style very similar to his teacher, Antoine Gingros, who was famous for his Napoleonic battle scenes. So the painting is huge. It's a 9x7. It looks like a battle scene with the ferociousness of the lions and everything, and the boars and the leopards. It's not historically accurate in the sense of how they died, but it does produce an emotion. And it was always a powerful message for me when I walked past it to see, I believe it's Perpetua, the one looking up to heaven in the midst of the trial there with all the animals around her. And walking past it, I would always think of my own situation with school and work and on, not to take away from the painting, but on a comical level, you could look at it and say, well, yeah, things could always definitely be worse. But for me, on a more spiritual, emotional level, it was that sort of full, compliant trust in what God was doing for you right now, in that his plan is always best. And even if it comes to something as terrible as that those ladies were facing at that moment, he would give to his children kind of what their names mean, Perpetua and Felicitas, that idea of everlasting joy. That was still going to be there. And that was always a powerful painting to me, to be able to see that and look at it every day. And when it is, again, viewed on campus or downtown or wherever possible, when that painting's viewed again, I hope that's the message they get from that painting, and always grateful for it, and to also the artist, Lullière, for giving that to us.
My name is Rebecca Cobb. I've served in various roles at the Museum and Gallery for the past 13 years. I am currently the registrar here at M&G, and that basically means I'm kind of the caretaker for the collection, so I keep track of where all our collection pieces are and what condition they're in. If they go out on loan, I get to travel with those, so it's a really fun job. And so I've been exposed to the collection for a nice long time. And for me, it's really hard to just pick one favorite. But if I had to, one of my absolute favorites is Christ and the Samaritan Woman by Francois de Troyes, who's a French artist. And that painting used to hang in Gallery 17. So if you've visited M&G in the past, that was the gallery I think most guests liked because it had a dark navy or black wallpaper and white carpet that was really soft. And it was kind of right in the middle. So as you got to that gallery, your feet got a nice little break. But for me, the dark walls especially made the colors of the painting pop, which then always grabbed my focus. Of the five paintings in M&G's collection of the story of the Samaritan woman, this one is my favorite. And if you're unfamiliar with the story, what happens is Christ and his disciples have to pass through Samaria on their way back to Galilee, which for them would have been distasteful, especially to any traveling Jew, because of the longstanding hatred and rivalry between the Jews and the Samaritans. So while Christ's disciples go in search of food, Christ chooses to rest at the Samaritan well, and there he encounters a Samaritan woman who's coming to draw water. And what I love most about this story is Christ does the unthinkable, and he engages the Samaritan woman in conversation and even asks her for a drink of water from her vessel. And de Troyes's Christ in his painting gently leans in to close the physical gap between them. But to me, it also removes the emotional barriers that have been built up by their conflicting cultures. And that contrasts with her standing in a very stiff, upright posture. Its small size makes the story feel more relatable and intimate, so it's not one of the larger, huge, enormous paintings in the collection. And I think that De Troyes' painting captures the moment of Christ offering this woman this living water that will forever quench the thirst that she has in her soul. And the artist's choice of color in the entire piece always gives me a sense of the warmness of Christ's compassion and his kindness and his gentleness toward a woman that society says he should despise. And the woman stands there listening intently, just in awe of that kindness and grace and mercy.
My name is Isaac Morales, and I had the privilege of being employed by the M&G for about 3 years. I served in several different capacities there, ranging from being a student worker to becoming a guard supervisor, graduate assistant as well. I also was part of the gift shop, which got me a little bit closer to the collection as I was answering different questions sometimes about the collection for our various guests. During all this time of working for the museum and gallery, I grew to love the collection as I spent hours in its presence almost every day. One of my favorites dwelt in the final gallery, so just about as you were exiting. It was a collection of gorgeous works by many Northern Renaissance artists. These craftsmen have become well known for their attention to detail of some of the most minuscule elements of their paintings, things such as folds and threads of their clothing, tree leaves in the background, and even to the extent of tiny people scattered across the landscape backgrounds. Decoder accomplished just that and more in his St. Michael the Archangel and St. Agnes. No matter where your gaze begins in this painting, you can see the skills of this old master. Although the faces of the main subjects, Michael and Agnes, are fairly placid, there is still deep expressivity in the painting. The main subjects of the painting stand symmetrically, dividing the painting in almost two halves. One side occupied by a vibrant white-clad Michael and the other by Agnes in deep red robes. The calmness of Agnes's lamb is asymmetrically juxtaposed by the languishing monstrous creature being attacked by Michael's staff. As Agnes stands calmly holding a book in her other hand, Michael's other hand holds a tilting scale. This bold contradiction between colors and actions in this painting really draws my attention, draws my eye, and gives it a real movement and emotion that is hard to put into words, but clearly speaks for itself. Meanwhile, as per Renaissance artists, every last corner of the painting is filled to the brim with various details and touches that add to the storyline inherent in the work. Things such as extra details in their robes, all those extra fabric folds, and even some very tiny, tiny threads next to the very edges of their cloaks. Decoder stopped at no cost at creating this elegant masterpiece, and every look that I took left me wanting more.
Hi, my name is Kirsten Dalton. I worked for M&G for 8 years, and then I moved to Chicago and worked in a city church for the last 11 years. And then I've just recently returned to M&G to serve as a museum educator. Upon my return to work, the imagery in the painting Patience by Frederick James Shields has arrested me. You know, I never noticed this painting too much before, but my experience in Chicago has now informed my looking at this painting, and it's really ministered to me now this time. Unlike many paintings, we're fortunate to have a paragraph written by the artist explaining the imagery. I won't read it now because you can go to M&G's website for yourself, but as I meditated on his words and his art, I was blessed. As I studied the painting, I was considering the tall female figure. She's personified as patience, and she calmly closes her eyes. I can almost hear her taking deep, measured breaths to regulate her pain, as her situation is less than comfortable. The unusual juxtaposition of objects piqued my senses. She's standing chained to the sundial. She's limited by time. It's not something under her control. Her wings might enable her to fly away from her trouble and be at rest, but she hears the Savior's call. Take my yoke upon you. Learn of me. The wooden yoke is strapped to her chest with a rope, but in her right hand, willingly, she embraces the relationship. It's a volitional choice that she's made as a response to the gift of the yoke, which has been tailor-made and is fitting. The setting describes human experience as the thorns of pain, old and new, physical and emotional, have wrapped around her legs. She waits. She waits. She waits. You can hear and feel the whole creation groaning in sorrow, waiting for redemption. There's the sense that this is not how it's supposed to be. The longer she's chained, the more thorns she experiences. Some are withered memories, while others currently pierce with even the slightest of her movements to breathe or balance or wait. The thorn of crown set upon her head flashes back to Christ, identifying with present insulting shame in this brokenness, while the glow about her head, the immeasurable future glory secured by his sacrifice. Look at the lamb slain at the base of the sundial. It tenderly hearkens unto Christ's words, I am meek and lowly. In the Father's plan, he is slain before the foundation of the world. God has laid on Jesus the iniquity of us all. To meditate on the scene at her feet brings her sorrow and unspeakable joy at the same time. She marvels on his humility of heart and obedience of deed. Who would have thought that a lamb could rescue the souls of men? It would be hard for her to articulate the depth of emotions she is now feeling. It would take a lifetime of recounting the details of the specific trials and the nuances of deliverance that has trained her expression. Looking at her calm face, you would have never guessed that she used to be a fiery, self-willed person, a daughter of Boanerges who thought she knew better than others. Now changed, she works like the patient farmer, scattering the precious seed in the field, sometimes seeing fruit, sometimes not, her seed bag on her left arm and her sickle ready to work in the assigned field as long as the Lord of the harvest allows. The harvest is ripe. I see the sun coming up at the start of a new day, new challenges, the regular rhythm ready to begin. Next to her heart, she tightly grasps her lifeline, the word of Christ. The seasoned Apostle Peter reminds, "For after you have suffered a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you." She can wait and endure and honor her Savior until he breaks through in his own timing in complete victory. What a plan! What a Savior!
My name is John Good. I currently am employed by the Museum and Gallery as a security manager. That actually takes in a little bit more than just taking care of the collection. Currently, with our closure, I also work in a curatorial position and have the opportunity to actually handle the paintings as well as talk about them, which is what I'm doing today. The painting that I chose for this session is entitled The Arrival at Emmaus, and it's by a Dutch artist by the name of Art Vandernier. As we consider this painting, the artist himself is interesting in a few different respects. Art van den Heer was born either in 1603 or 1604 in a little town called Gorinchem, which is in the Netherlands. However, he lived most of his life in Amsterdam. He is known as a landscape painter of the Dutch Golden Age, and his forte, as one critic stated, is that he is a perfect painter of both night scenes and skating scenes. Art enjoyed representing this area of Europe in his paintings, using the canals, either when they were thawed out and the water was flowing freely, or else even during the wintertime when they were covered with ice and they were the scene of skating, even at night. And a number of his paintings come together with the moonlight skaters on canals there in that part of Holland. For Art van den Heer, the early part of his life was taken up with other activities other than painting, and his first pieces actually do not appear until he was perhaps in his mid-30s. The piece today has a wonderful representation of a cathedral that you would probably find in the city of Delft. And in the daylight that is fading, you find ducks that are preparing for a night's rest. And in the distance are the two disciples that we read of in Luke's Gospel, chapter 24, who had invited Christ to abide with them because the day is coming to a close. Previously, these three had walked together from Jerusalem towards Emmaus, a distance of at least 6 or 7 miles. And van den Heer, of course, represents a Dutch city instead of a city in Palestine because he was familiar with the Dutch cities instead. And as the large trees are appearing darker as well against the yellowing sky and the reflections on the river are muted, the clouds appear to portend even a possible weather situation coming on, but the good news is that this day is just the first of a new era that leads to what the disciples were looking beyond the encroaching darkness, and that's to an eternal day. The message that we find in Luke 24, of course, is a very interesting one, and for those of us as believers, we find it to be a very comforting one because not only had these disciples been joined by Christ as they journeyed home from Jerusalem, but they also left Jerusalem with heavy hearts because they had unanswered questions in their minds and also on their lips as they shared with Christ, who they did not recognize at that time, their desire to have seen something happen with him other than just being crucified and buried, and they had heard reports of the fact that his body was no longer able to be located. And during their journey, of course, Christ took the time to exposit himself to them from Old Testament scriptures. And as he appeared to be heading on beyond their stopping point in Emmaus, they urged him to abide with them. And during the time that they were partaking of their meal, Christ took the position of the host. He blessed and broke the bread, and in so doing, he also opened their eyes to see that it really indeed is he. And with truth as wonderful as this, the only thing that these dear believers could do is go ahead and make a return trip to Jerusalem and meet up with the disciples again and tell them that the Lord is risen indeed. You know, as it was true on that day many years ago, it is still true today that Christ indeed is alive. He can open spiritually blind eyes, and he wants to abide with you, even as he tells us in John chapter 15 and verse 4, "Abide in me, and I in you, as a branch cannot bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine. No more can you, except ye abide in me."
My name is Linda St. John. I taught in the speech communication department for a little over 40 years. If I had not had that privilege of teaching there, I always thought I would love to work in the art gallery as a docent. My first experience or acquaintance with the gallery came when I was a student, an undergraduate student. I was taking a course in art appreciation and working also as a guide or hostess there. after I discovered the Gerrit Hunter's painting, I fell in love with it. It was called The Holy Family in the Carpenter Shop. It became my favorite. My feet seemed to take me there every time I came to the gallery, and I would feel warmed and refreshed and peaceful after I viewed it. The scene in the painting is simple, as the title suggests. The setting is illuminated by lantern light. Much of the rest of the scene is in shadow. The painter was noted for his use of lighting effects and was part of a group called the Candlelighters, or the Candlelight Painters. The light reveals first the first unit that God established, the family. The faces of the Holy Family speak of goodness, unity, and love. Joseph, the father, is intent on his craft. There is strength of purpose in his face. There is strength in the illuminated arm, which suggests his protection over the family by his focus on his work and the certainty of his skill. Mary, the mother, is by his side in a supporting role as she looks on peacefully, watching her husband ply his skill. Her focus on his work, it's serene because she knows the goodness of his heart as a wise and trustworthy man who has protected her and her son in their very unusual circumstances. The cast is complete as we look at the young Christ who radiates purity. The innocency of youth is in his face, as well as his desire to help his family by holding the light for his father. He too is intent upon his work and purpose. His arm also is illuminated, showing strength and pointing clearly and directly to the Father's work. The light is central in the painting. The artist seems to be saying that Jesus is the light of the world, and he's there to help his Father accomplish his purpose for his people. On another level, it reminds me of the love and harmony and unity of purpose that should be found in each of our Christian homes. I suppose that is why this is my favorite painting. It reminds me of Jesus as the light of the world and what our homes should be.
Before we conclude, I thought it might be particularly meaningful to hear a recording from an old audio tour guided personally by M&G's founder, Dr. Bob Jones Jr. Listen as he shares about one of his favorites in the collection, a collection that he gathered for our continuing enjoyment and appreciation.
I'm coming now into the section of the gallery that are my special favorites. I love these early Renaissance Flemish pictures. There's so much about them that's colorful. And I like the highly finished quality of these pictures, almost as if they were enameled. There are the details of the landscapes. Sometimes they're very wonderful. You know, these people painting in the lowlands, many of them had never seen mountains. They'd heard descriptions of mountains. So when they wanted to paint a landscape that had hills, they'd get a little bit of shale and stick it in some dirt to make a hill for the landscape. That's why you find so often the mountains in these pictures go straight up, almost like the mountains in Chinese paintings. These Flemish pictures are beautiful for the fall of the drapery. This one, which is one of my very special favorites, is attributed to John Gassot, who is also called Mabus. We call it the Madonna of the Fireplace. My wife calls it the Madonna with the Pablum, because the angel is coming in with the milk soup for the baby and it looks like Pablum. The angel's robes and wings blend beautifully together. The Madonna's warming her hand by the fire before she changes a little child. The swaddling clothes are in the basket. In the corner by the fireplace, there's a bellus for warming up the coals. And there's an apple roasting on the hearth. There's a little walker for the child also. That little instrument with four wheels and four legs that the child can be put in and allowed to walk a little bit. The room is paneled with paneling very much like the room in which it hangs. It comes from the Cook collection, which was a very famous English collection of the last century.
Even though all of our guests shared works from the Old Master collection, M&G is more than paintings, with objects representing more than 45 centuries of mankind's culture from England to Russia and as far south as Egypt. The historical breadth, artistic quality, and unique religious focus of the collection provide an encompassing survey of the past with meaningful links touching every discipline and subject today. If you are missing the art or simply curious about what the museum and gallery is, visit our website at bjumg.org.